This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Now, if you were in South Burlington this past weekend, you may have felt more like you were transported to a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Probably because a group of white plastic-clad stormtroopers caught your eye. Or maybe you felt a little safer staring up at the vaguely human tree being known as Groot from Guardians of the Galaxy as he lumbered by. These are just a couple of the costumes worn by the scores of fans who transformed the Sheraton Hotel into an alternate universe of science fiction, fantasy, and comic book nirvana at the second annual Vermont Comic-Con.
Oh, yeah, I actually took 5 days off of work for this.
Brian Walsh, I live in Swanton.
I am a mixture of X-Men Origins Wolverine and X-Men 1, where Wolverine has kind of like the cowboy hat, belt buckle, cowboy boots, his claws and leather jacket, and then his dog tags that remind him of who he was and where he came from. I like that he pretty much can't die, and he's, for looking 35, he's really like 275 years old. So he pretty much can never die unless he gets decapitated and then they send his head to another country. Video games, comics, nerddom, geekdom, everything, it's been my life. I build computers, I do all kinds of stuff, so I like being myself. I feel like I'm around a lot of people that need to let this type of side of them show in real life all the time, because it doesn't matter where I am, I'm at work, I'm in public, I just go full geek.
And going full geek was definitely a badge of honor for people at Vermont Comic-Con. Sam Maskell is a librarian from Bellows Falls who picks up our theme from there.
Well, I am a geek, so this is all things I love. This is a really fun place to be, and it's great to be in this community with all these people.
How do you define geek?
A person who's excited about something. There's lots of different geekdoms. You can geek out about Doctor Who. You can geek out about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or games. So a geek is someone who can get excited about something. I'm here scoping out some of the indie comics and talking to creators, which is a lot of fun. I love the costumes. That's always one of my favorite things, is just to watch and see what people have created. I've met some great creators down in Artist's Alley.
Costumes, artists, comic books, it was all part of the mix this weekend at Vermont Comic-Con. And joining me today are some exhausted organizers of the event. One of them, anyway, is Jay Moulton, the owner and organizer of Vermont Comic-Con. Jay, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we're also joined in the studio by Wendy and Skip Farrell. They're a married couple. Skip Farrell is a patron of the arts in Burlington. Wendy is an award-winning costumer. Thank you both for being with us today.
Happy Pleasure. To be here.
Really appreciate it. And welcome to Vermont Edition. Jay, I want to start with you. This was the second Vermont Comic-Con. I want you to describe first just how much it grew from 1 year to the next.
Oh, boy, that's a really loaded question. The first year, we decided to just try the event because, it didn't exist in Vermont before. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we just had moderate expectations to see if the crowd would like to do this show. We had a 15,000-square-foot space. It was filled last year. And I know the people of Vermont are really fans of art and culture and pop culture, geek culture. So we decided to double the size. I've got a brand new team for this year. We blew the doors off beyond my expectations. It just seems to me that the people of Burlington and the surrounding areas have this need for and a want for pop culture to exist in one location where they can be themselves and have a good time.
Yeah, and Vermont is pretty ripe for this sort of thing. I mean, after all, the Center for Cartoon Studies in White River Junction, you know, you've got some great cartoonists there and people that love that genre for sure. For the uninitiated, though, and it seems like it's part of the popular culture now and people would know this, but some folks may not. How would you describe what a Comic-Con is?
Well, it's different. I mean, I can tell you what Vermont Comic-Con is. I'm not going to speak for San Diego or New York or any places like that.
Right.
Vermont Comic-Con for me is a great mix of art, media, charity, and it's welcome. It's family friendly. Welcomes every person in who wants to come. And there's something for everybody. It's very interactive. We keep things moving. We've got panels. We've got media guests, artists doing sketch offs. Great panels. So it's something we're very excited, a brand that we're excited to bring. So that's all I can say about Vermont Comic-Con as far as being a Comic-Con.
It really is a celebration of pop culture in all of its facets. You know, at walking around the show the last 2 days this weekend, you saw gaming, you saw people with television and movies background, you saw people from the visual arts, artists, writers. It was costuming. You really saw a very broad spectrum of American pop culture.
And costuming is a big part of this. And Wendy Farrell, let me ask you, I mean, you've designed costumes of your own. You've worn costumes. Did you wear a costume to Comic-Con this weekend?
I pulled a few things out of the closet.
What does that mean?
It means I was not recreating any particular character, but I looked cool enough that several dozen people stopped to take my picture.
They did. Can you describe what you were wearing to us?
I had a wonderful green leather hat covered with plumage, a black leather corset, and a steampunk fan.
A steampunk fan? What is that?
It's a fan, like a lady's fan, oh, okay. But it's created out of leather and brass fixtures by a steampunk artisan of whom I am a huge fan, Thomas Williford.
Now, you told me before the show started that you consider yourself Wonder Wendy Farrell. Does this mean that you often have a Wonder Woman costume that you get dressed up in at times? Or
I hate to admit, I have several Wonder Woman costumes of different eras and different representations.
We're celebrating all things geek here today. You don't have to hate to admit that. It's fine.
It's a badge of honor, really.
It's a badge of honor.
It is. So I have everything from a medieval Wonder Woman up to a modern interpretation.
All I can say is last weekend when she went off the roof over the edge as a fundraiser for the Flynn Theater, she was wearing a Wonder Woman costume.
So if people looked up in the sky, there they saw Wonder Woman coming down the side of the building.
One of my kids posted, "My mom really is a superhero."
That's very cool. Jay Moulton, one of the Vermont authors who attended the event was Jeremy Holt. He told us that he noticed people wanting to know if he's local and that the Vermont congoers really appreciate the local talent. And you were saying, you can speak to Vermont Comic-Con specifically. He hadn't experienced that going to the bigger cons. How do you cultivate that Vermont identity and ethos at Vermont Comic Con?
Well, I really think they're homegrown. What we do is we research who's around the area, whether it's Jeremy Holt, Blair Shedd, Cliff Rathburn, even Dan Parents originally from Vermont. If you know your area and you know your demographic, you'll find those people easily. But to show the people of Vermont that does exist in their towns and in their state. It just brings to the forefront why there needs to be a Comic-Con in Vermont and how we can celebrate that.
Skip Farrell, let me ask you, you're a patron of the arts in Burlington. You've organized some major events, and yet you embrace comic books, which may not seem quite as sophisticated, let's say. But how has that perception of comics as something that we consume as media changed over the years?
Well, it's not kid stuff anymore. Hmm. Certainly I learned how to read, as did most of my generation, I think, reading comic books. But comic books have kind of grown up with their audience in the last 40 or 50 years, and so it really has become something that young people really identify with. The characters are probably more popular and more well known than ever before. The readership of the print magazines, notwithstanding, you can make a mention of Superman or Iron Man or Batman and the Avengers, and everybody knows about it. Everybody has an opinion of it, and it's very much a fun part of our American culture.
We're talking comic books today. We're talking Comic-Con, Vermont Comic-Con specifically. Were you at Vermont Comic-Con this weekend? Did you get dressed up? Tell us about your experience. If you were there, you can join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. I'll get it right. We just came off the fun drive, and so I've got that number in my head. 1-800-639-2211, or go to our Vermont Edition Facebook page, post your question there. We have some guests in the studio. We have some more on the way, we believe, and we're going to have a lot of fun talking about comic books and the comic book community today. Wendy Farrell, one of the things that I've noticed about comic books changing just over the last, say, 10 years or so is that there's a more of an effort now to embrace women and to get more women characters in an expanded role, perhaps to bring in younger readers who are female in what has traditionally been a very male-dominated culture. How did you get into comic books? Were you always a comic book fan from a young age?
I have to honestly say no. I actually had my brother's box of comic books, which were the History Illustrated ones.
Classics Illustrated. I remember those, yeah.
And I pored over those. So, you know, I don't think I've actually read Treasure Island, but I saw the illustrated version. I got the high notes, you know. And I was a big Archie reader. So meeting Dan Parent this past weekend was kind of cool, even though he wasn't drawing when I was a kid.
Tell us who Dan Parent is.
Dan Parent is currently illustrating Archie comic books.
Yeah, he's one of the major artists for the entire Archie line. And he's originally a Vermonter. His parents were at the con yesterday.
It was the first con they'd ever been to.
The first one, and they really enjoyed it. They were very happy to see their son at work.
So you got into comic books maybe a little bit later as far as the more traditional superhero genre went.
It was a marriage made in heaven when I met Skip, because I was already a bit of a Trekkie. Okay, a lot of a Trekkie.
Live long and prosper, and I'm right there with you.
And I've been doing competitive costuming, but I hadn't discovered this world of comic cons until I met Skip.
You're going to have to define competitive costuming for me.
There's a group called the International Costumers Guild that runs sanctioned events. The closest one is in Boston in January.
Wow. Jay Moulton, we're talking about Vermonters, folks who have a long traditional history here. One of the most revered names in comic books, of course, is Frank Miller, who revitalized the Dark Knight Batman series, and that has just exploded now. I understand that he's originally from Vermont.
He is. He's kind of
Montpelier area.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay.
You know, Frank Miller is one of the pioneers of comics. I mean, especially for my generation. I'm 40 years old. I grew up reading The Dark Knight. Frank Miller works. Sin City's a favorite of mine. But Frank Miller has really given a huge audience the Batman we know now, The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
Different galaxies, different avenues that Batman's never gone down. So to have him be a native Vermonter is really cool. Love to get him at an event. So, Frank, if you're listening, you have an open invite any year, anytime you want.
You never know. Well, we do have someone on the line right now who is well known to many Vermonters involved in the illustrating community. Let's go to South Burlington, and I believe Harry is on the phone. Harry?
Hey, Mitch. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. Harry Bliss. How are you?
This is great. Doing well. Just wanted to call and just offer support, man. I mean, I noticed that the Comic-Con was just up the street because my studio's in South Burlington, I guess, last year. I didn't know what was going on this weekend, but I wish I had gone because, you know, usually my buddies, you know, we're all huge comic book art collectors. That's kind of what I do with all my money these days. I have some great original Kirbys and Crumbs and Graham Engels and the Seamas and all sorts of stuff. But, yeah, man, I just think it's fantastic, and I'm so excited that it's here in Vermont finally, so I don't have to go all the way to the West Coast to participate. And maybe next year I'll get out there and check it out.
But I mean, Harry, most people know you and your illustrations, of course, from The New Yorker. Did you ever have ambitions to be a comic book artist, though?
Yeah.
Superhero, absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, to get into that realm.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I grew up reading primarily Marvel comics. You know, we used to take our little stupid banana seat bikes down to Empire Comics in Rochester, New York on Mount Hope Avenue. And, you know, I'd buy what are now worthless comics, but I was a huge fan of, like, Tomb of Dracula, Werewolf by Night, Man-Thing, Swamp Thing. And,
oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I spent a lot of time as a kid copying all these comics, specific panels and pages by some of the greats, Bernie Wrightson and Barry Windsor Smith and all these guys. So I had great aspirations. I wanted to do comics. In fact, I'm about to start a graphic novel in the next few weeks, I guess, which I've never done before. So I'm a little freaked out about that. But
No, don't be. Thank you for telling us that we've got that to look forward to. Harry Bliss, thank you very much for the call. Really appreciate it. You know, you can tell Harry's passion for illustration, for comics here. You know, I grew up reading Daredevil. He was my first comic book hero love. Howard the Duck, I think, is one of the great comics ever. But I also think that, you know, as these got adapted by the movies, let's say, by Hollywood, something got a little lost in translation. And I don't know who wants to field this question first, but would you agree with me that Hollywood has not brought the feel of the comic books that perhaps we all in this room love to the big screen?
Well, they've certainly done their best. I mean, it's very tough to translate from image to film, whether it's Sin City, which looks frame by frame to be very accurate.
And that's a Frank Miller creation as well.
Or The Watchmen. Yeah. Watchmen was very close. Mm-hmm. But sometimes people interpret the comics for themselves. They see the scenery. They imagine in their mind what it looks like, and it's just through a different person's point of view that I think that's the real disconnect.
Hmm. Well, I think sometimes Hollywood gives us what they think we want, and they don't know the comic book fan. You know, they don't know why we're reading the comic book. Mm-hmm. And this is one of Skip's bully pulpits. I shouldn't steal it from him. But the fact that Superman is a hero, he shouldn't be an anti-hero. And Hollywood keeps trying to make him another Batman. And he's not another Batman. He's Superman.
Skip, would you agree?
I would absolutely. Wendy has heard me say that on more than one occasion. you know, a lot of the heroes are just that. They're two-dimensional, but that's what we love about them. They, you know where you stand with, with Superman. You know where you stand with Daredevil or Iron Man. There's not so very much ambiguity these are the good guys, and they're the ones you root for, and Hollywood still too often tries to make all these characters into anti-heroes, and that's not what they are.
Back to some sounds and scenes from Vermont Comic Con this weekend. Liana Petrozzini lives in Burlington. She attended in costume, and a friend persuaded her to come to last year's Vermont Comic Con. Now she counts herself as invested in Comic Con.
When I was little, I was really into Pokemon and Powerpuff Girls and Spider-Man. I would wake up really early in the morning to watch those shows. It just grew and grew and grew from there. My costume is Rin Kagamine from the Vocaloid series. It's not actually a comic series, but rather more of a musical series. It's spawned a lot of, its own individual smaller comics, but it mostly is a platform for people that want to get into music. It's sort of a niche fandom, but I really enjoy it, and I've found a number of people that really enjoy it as well. The specific version of this costume that I'm wearing, it's a sort of monochrome, black and white, but it has yellow accents and a lot of ruffles, so it's sort of similar to a Gothic Lolita costume in a way. It's not that, though. I have one of those, but it's not that.
I'm glad she made that clear. Now, a lot of people were in costume, and there is a term that's used in the comics community. Definitely did not exist back in the day when I was devouring Daredevil, et cetera. And the term is cosplay. Wendy, can you explain to us what cosplay is?
Well, you've just tapped into a whole conversation, because cosplay and costumers are right now embroiled in debate over superiority in terminology. And costumers are about creativity and creating costumes, where cosplay often is about sourcing and putting together, although there is a lot of creation and a lot of do-it-yourself type DIY world that's incredible and creative. But cosplayers want to live their character more often than not, whereas costumers are more of a pure creativity and presentation. It's not about necessarily living that character.
So a cosplay person who's into that will not just create a costume for themselves, but really try to work in the ethos of that character, their everyday lives, to the extent that they can.
As much as they can. They often want to fully embody and be that character for that length of time.
Wow.
And not that there's anything wrong with that, because, how many of us never break out of our mundane day-to-day? Yeah. And I think that's part of the fun of a Comic Con, is you step outside of your realm of reality and you get to play. You get to be a kid again. Skip talked about how comic books have changed. Remember all those guys who were your friends who said, my mom threw away my box of comic books?
Oh, yeah. We all have that story.
Yeah.
Yep.
And guess what? Mom doesn't do that anymore.
Right.
You can keep your box of comic books until you're 50, 60, 75. We see all ages at the Comic Con.
Wendy and Skip Farrell, thank you very much. We're about to head to a break, but we want you to join the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-639-2211, or you can write to us on our Vermont Edition Facebook page, or send us an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. We're talking comic books today, Vermont Comic Con, and much more. And by the way, fans of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, please stay with us. Nicholas Brendan joins us just ahead. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. We're talking Comic-Con today here on Vermont Edition. All things comic book and much, much more. And we're also talking about folks that were at Comic-Con this weekend, and certainly one of them was a guy named Dan Flanders of Essex. He works as a buyer at a health food store. And our producer, Patty Daniels, met him at Comic-Con this weekend. He was selling elaborate homemade skull masks. And they look like real bone. They've got some long horns that twist up from the temples. And Dan himself was wearing a mask over his long dreadlocks. It looked like two skulls mashed together with sets of teeth protruding from each cheekbone.
I am wearing my new double skull mask that fits both sides of my face. There is a jaw. And I also have horns. Lovely, lovely horns.
And did you make that yourself?
I did indeed. All of my masks are made from recycled cardboard and paper clay.
Can I touch it?
Oh, by all means. They're all pretty darn sturdy.
It looks so molded.
Thank you. I have a really good relationship with paper, so I essentially do origami folds to the cardboard bases and then make them really sturdy and then add a little bit of my paper clay to it and a couple of finishes, a couple of trade secrets, and knock out a nice mask. My wife and I both wish that I had an actual workshop, but for the time being, I have a pretty good workspace. It kind of happened on its own. I made some just for fun, and then I put them on my Etsy 3-4 years ago, and it's just taken off from there. And I come up with a few other ones, like the demon skull line, or I have like the dragon skull and a monster over here. But just nice basic skull mask, can't beat it. Can't beat it. The cosplayers are really interested in custom work. That they haven't, you know, figured out how to make a certain mask, and so I'll probably be helping with some of that.
Flanders, mask maker from Essex, Dan Flanders, and we are talking about comic books today. We want you to join the conversation as well. 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a photo on the Vermont Edition Facebook page if you were dressed up for Vermont Comic Con this weekend. Maybe you have dressed up in the past as your favorite comic book hero. And here with me in the studio is the owner of Vermont Comic Con, Jay Moulton. And joining us now as well is Johnny Gummo, event coordinator. Thanks for being here, Johnny.
Well, thanks for having me.
And for fans of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, we've got news for you. Get ready to geek out. Joining us here in the studio is Nicholas Brendan, who played Xander in that TV series. Nikki, thanks so much for being here on Vermont Edition today.
Of course. I just want to let you know that I also have a very good relationship with paper.
You too have a good relationship with paper, as our friend Dan Flanders.
Yeah, that's a great emulation. Terrific.
Nick, let me start with you. I want to ask what, you know, you are Hollywood royalty. You are a recognizable star. I recognized your face as soon as you walked into the studio. So what drew you to attend Vermont Comic Con?
I love my fans, and I love meeting my fans. I love Johnny, who's a friend of mine.
And she asked
me to come.
A lot of love in the
room. We all love Nick.
And I met Jay a few years ago, so they asked me to come, and I said, yeah.
Now, how did this event, you know, Vermont Comic-Con not obviously being as big as, like, San Diego Comic-Con, the best-known one, how does it compare?
Because I've been to San Diego many, many, many times, these are wonderful. Like, when this is a well-oiled machine. You had enough people to where it was really worthwhile for everybody. Boy, the San Diego one, it's too much.
Really?
Yeah, and I know that they had started off as a comic book, right? You know, like vendors, essentially. Excuse me. And it's just really, and I get it, and it's become very commercial. But for me, it's really hard to walk through this space for two reasons. I get stopped a lot, and I actually forget that I'm a celebrity because I'm there to see friends. And secondly, it's just so crowded. So if you have any type of spatial issues with people, it's just really...
It can be a little overwhelming.
Very overwhelming, yeah. Very.
Now, I understand that you've been working on some new Buffy comic books.
Yes.
What are you involved in that effort?
I am writing them this year.
Fantastic.
And so the first four I wrote with my writing partner, Christos Gage, who also is a writer on the TV show Daredevil. They made it into a volume one, so it was a graphic novel, and that graphic novel went to the bestsellers list on the New York Times. So you are talking to a New York Times best-selling author.
As well as a famous actor.
Yes.
Who played Xander on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Let me ask you, Johnny Gummo, about coordinating an event like this. Was it a daunting task? Did it all come together, or are you exhausted just like Jay is today?
She's probably more exhausted than I am.
I think, in general, the answer to all of that is yes.
Yeah.
We started out, whenever I joined on, we knew that we were looking to at least parallel last year's show and bring something, you know, a little bit more value to it. And the fact of the matter is that Vermont is a magical place. And I can't even express to you how many times it seems like literal magic has happened to help pull this con even more closely knit. You know, for instance, last week we just, you know, by happenstance ran into Colin Trevorrow while we were at the town center. And he said, oh, hey, you've got Hawk coming, which Hawk was a serendipitous guest as well. And he offered himself to us, you know, just for the sake of making an amazing thing happen. But it got to the point where it was overwhelming because in the past 3 weeks, all of our logistics went out the window as we realized that as these awesome things that were being added into the show could potentially just break our entire system. So fortunately, we had a really, really awesome staff who came into everything having done cons before. Yep. And they had the insight and the wherewithal to put out fires before there was smoke, really. And as far as I can tell, they were able to fix things that could have been problems before I ever knew that there was a problem. So it was daunting, but I think at the end of the day, thanks to the people of Vermont and just the magical air, it just came together like a dream.
Did you learn some things this time around that will, in planning for next year, you know, keep it more manageable?
Absolutely. One thing that we definitely learned was Vermont loves their cosplayers, and Vermont loves Doctor Who. And we were absolutely not prepared for the overwhelming response to particular panels. And so moving forward in the future, we will look at our systems to make sure that all of the people who want seats have seats without causing any last minute.
You should have come to my panel.
Your panel was interesting.
I had a lot of
panel.
Empty seats in my panel.
I find that hard to believe.
So did I.
Okay, so Nikki's panel really, really got, you know, took a hit. Unfortunately, what had happened was that we had to make last minute adjustments and entirely push back the timing and the location of our costume contest, which meant that we actually had to shift all the audio visual upstairs only. So there were no announcements that were able to be made downstairs because we had this flux of people upstairs that needed to be entertained by this contest. So we just really had to, you know, cut our losses at something and put the effort into the
show. I got fully naked. Right. That's all I can say.
However, Nikki's panel went great. The moderator absolutely loved him. And the fans said they got some really, really great stories out of him. I popped my head in for a second, gave him a good laugh, a thumbs up, and you know, the fact of the matter is Vermont is actually much more, it seems to be a creator's territory. And we had our creators workshops that were full. They were pushed to the gills. And anytime that the artists had a chance to come together and learn something or swap ideas, the room was just almost overwhelming with positive energy. And the celebrities, as much, you know, we love Nikki, we love Brimstone, and the Clerks guys, Brian O'Halloran, and then Rochelle Davis. We love these people, and they were great guests. But at our show, it was almost like they were a bit more supplemental, like a treat.
Mm-hmm. A little gravy on the main course.
Exactly.
On the poutine, which I had yesterday.
Poutine is
for the
amazing
first time.
Yes. I'm telling you.
Lobster poutine.
Our friends in Montreal, of course, will want credit for that. It's a Quebec thing, but we have it here too. Nicholas Brendon, I do want to ask, because Johnny just touched on something I find really interesting. You sound very passionate about your work on Buffy, and you held this panel. You're working on the comic book now. Some actors, I would guess, I'm not asking you to name any names, they will take a role that's a comic book or a superhero role, and they figure, okay, this is my stepping stone to, you know, a more serious role or something like that. How do you feel about the character that you embraced, Xander? Is this something that you're proud of, that you don't mind being? I'm sure people on the street see you go, hey, there's Xander. I mean, how do you feel about that?
You know, I always said that Xander was the second coolest character ever on TV, behind the Fonz. And then I'm like, you know what? Xander never jumped the shark.
That's right. And Sarah Michelle Gellar may wonder why you're not saying she was the coolest.
Well, because I mean, just in regards to what my character did, he was just the funny guy, and he was just the everyday guy, and he was a guy that everybody could relate to. So, it was called Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but I just, every There wasn't a time where I got a script that I just didn't laugh out loud. And I'm happy that I could do the jokes and the emotions justice. But I miss him. I don't miss the wardrobe so much, but, you know, that's a part of... Because I play a character on Criminal Minds. His name's Kevin Lynch, so it's the last 8 years. And he's actually very Xander-like. So it's kind of... I get to kind of reprise the role, but without Joss Whedon's dialogue.
But I'm sure that your fans are so glad that you're not pushing that away. You're not running away from it. You're not... You know, we hear about movie stars that go to San Diego Comic-Con, and they make some disparaging remarks about the folks there. Not everyone in Hollywood really embraces this, but you do.
100%. I would not be here in Vermont if it wasn't for my fans. I don't. I really have it. That's a sore subject for me, and I don't particularly get along with actors. So,
well, we're certainly glad you're here.
That's why I'm writing now. Because
it's really rare for a lot of us to get along with
actors. Because I want to tell them what to say now and have them stop talking so much.
You know, we also...
Not all actors, mind you. Not all actors.
No, just the ones that are cool. Yeah, we understand that. One area of Vermont Comic-Con was reserved just for gaming. The game room had a bunch of tables set up. Expert gamers were teaching tabletop games to the newbies. And we met Bethany Creaser there from Derby Line, Vermont. And she's a member of Green Mountain Gamers. She said she and her husband accidentally got into gaming, but then quickly got hooked.
Everyone knows the traditional, you know, Monopoly, Sorry, Clue. But these games, there's a whole world out there that's way different than those. And the first game we bought in that world was Carcassonne. And that game hooked us. And now here we're helping here at the game room at Comic-Con. We're part of Green Mountain Gamers. We go to gaming events. We started our own game group. So that's what got us started. I've always loved board games. You know, growing up, I knew the traditional games, and I was always asking people to play with me. And then it wasn't until after college that I actually got involved in playing role-playing games like Dungeons & Dragons. And then a friend of ours suggested some of these board games to us, and that's when we bought Carcassonne and got hooked on the board games, too. I think a lot of younger kids today play video games because that's what was available to them. But I find that, you know, we do see younger kids, and if somebody takes the time to sit down with them, they'll play a board game or a card game or a role-playing game or any kind of non-electronic game. The kids usually really enjoy it as much as the video games.
That's Bethany Creaser from Derby Line. Johnny Gummo, let me ask you, what are some of the big trends in the gaming world today?
You are actually talking to the absolutely wrong person.
Jay Moulton, let me ask you, what are some of the big trends in the gaming world today?
Well, a lot of big trends. And honestly, I know just a tiny fraction more than Johnny because neither of us are avid gamers, but Magic is a very big game. A lot of role-playing, live-action role-playing, I guess LARPing is what they call it.
LARPing?
I may not have the correct term, but it... Huh.
Live-action role-playing.
Right, they walk around with...
Yeah. I've seen some movies about LARPing. Maybe not the same LARP.
What were their ratings?
Yeah, exactly. I'm wondering what the ratings are for that. Remember, this
Poutine
is a family
was involved.
Program right. Today. Yes,
Poutine
yes.
was involved.
But we had a collection of gamers, and the room was headed by Braps Magic. But it really just had a lot of tabletop things, tabletop games that I've never seen before. I mean, they had Carcassonne, they had Magic, Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh,
Dragon Hair.
But it's something that I. All of us really need to be more aware of because we are not huge experts on gaming.
The fact of the matter is we're business people.
That's right. I mean,
and
in the door.
The reason that we got involved in the relationship with Braps Magic here in Burlington is because we can only know so many things about so many things,
right.
And so we just turn it over to the people that really have their thumb on the pulse of the industry.
Which is good because if you pretended, like you can't pretend to be a nerd,
right?
No.
Like
so you're,
you know, either are or you're not.
The nerd dar is going to be like, this person's, they're faking it.
Right.
You don't want to be a poser. I mean,
and the fact of the matter is you
no.
can be a nerd in so many different ways, and I can only afford, you know, financially and so many hours in the day to be a certain number of types of nerd. So I turn that over to the people that, like, live it and breathe it and look forward to the next great thing, and they build that community and they bridge us together.
Right. Like, my background's in comics and business, and, you know, I've got a full sleeve of tattoos that are comics. I used to own a comic store. There's so many things I've done in the comic industry, nothing famous or anything, but
well, you're not a New York Times best-selling author?
Yeah, I'm working on that one.
Like our guest.
Well,
why am I here
then? Why am I here?
That's right, exactly.
I need equals.
That's right. So we take care of the business part, The gaming, not so much.
But I like the fact that there was, you know, tabletop games. I know the video game thing is huge. It's never been my bag. You know, I think things have branched out so much. But there was also a Comic-Con Junior space set up at the event?
It was. It was run by Emily Druin of Eplis Comics, a self-published book. Nathan Porter taught Jedi classes during the weekend for kids. It was free to kids that wanted to do that. We're obviously kids 700 gun and free, so it was something great the parents could bring their children to. And face painting, something that every kid can come in, feel like they just went through a whole Comic-Con themselves in their own little area.
I don't know, the Jedi training thing for kids sounds very dangerous to me because, you know, what if those kids master the Jedi mind trick, right? And then they try to...
Well, I think
what
they do is they have to master the pool noodles that they were swinging around like swords. It was absolutely adorable.
If they do master the Jedi mind trick, they can...
It would just be a bunch of... They would be eating a lot of Pop-Tarts. You know, it's like you got... they wouldn't use it for evil. I can say this, though, that the people of Vermont, everyone that I met here was just... Absolutely wonderful. I mean, you go to a lot of these events and you have a lot of fans who have they feel almost entitled. And I think a lot of it has to do with being a TV star. You're in their living room. So right. they just get very touchy-feely and say, get over here. This was almost...
It doesn't help that you offer free hugs.
Well, I do offer free hugs. And I'm known for my hugs. But this was very kind of like the people here are very, very European.
Would you come back?
Heck... Can I say heck?
I'm so glad you said heck just
heck,
now.
Heck, yeah.
And we'd love to have him back anytime, honestly. He's been a great guest.
Like, I'm not leaving is what I'm saying.
That's fantastic.
I'm gonna sleep under your table.
I mean, it's really pretty cool. You know, we've had, I don't know if we've ever had this many guests on Vermont Edition talking about this one topic, but it's so all-encompassing now as we talk, you know, video games, comic books, board games, costume play, just the wealth of this. But, you know, we've got a real Hollywood star in the studio with us today.
And that's Nicholas
Brendan. You're right there, New York Times best-selling author. Nicholas Brendan, thank you very much for being
here. Thank you very
much. I really appreciate it. Johnny Gummo, the event coordinator for Vermont Comic Con and the owner and organizer of Vermont Comic Con, Jay Moulton, thank you so much for taking the time to come in today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
And good luck with the event going forward. Thanks to all of you for geeking out with us today and coming up here on Vermont Edition. That's right, it's sheep. How an experiment to send Vermont sheep to Australia in the 1800s didn't work out so well. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. Now, it's not about to displace the cow as the go-to image people have when they think of the most iconic Vermont animal, but sheep have a deep and rich history of their own in the Green Mountain State. And half a world away, the legacy of Vermont sheep has quite a bit of importance as well, specifically Merino sheep. They were exported to Australia in the 1800s for reasons we'll discover in a moment as we speak with Rebecca Woods, who's delivering the keynote address at the annual Vermont Historical Society meeting this weekend. Rebecca Woods is a Vermont native who grew up in Montpelier and is now a lecturer in history at Columbia University, specializing in environmental history and the history of science. She's joining us online from New York City today. And Rebecca Woods, thank you so much for being with us on Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
First, what is special about Merino sheep? Where did they come from originally?
Well, they originally come from Spain, and what makes them special is the fineness of their wool. They grow the finest wool of any breed of sheep. I believe only cashmere, which are goats, grow a finer fiber that can be used for clothing. So this is why they traveled so far and wide in the 19th century.
And why were they an important animal in 19th century Vermont?
It's really interesting. So prior to 1801, there were no Merino sheep whatsoever in any American states. And during the Napoleonic Wars around 1810, 1811, American diplomats started exporting large numbers of sheep. There was kind of like a Merino bubble around this time, and everybody wanted to invest in them as a way to establish American manufacturing that could compete with and kind of break the nation's dependence on Britain for manufactured wool goods. They become important in Vermont because Merino sheep are a little bit unusual relative to other breeds of sheep in that they like places that are really, really hot or quite cold. Hmm. And so they did very well in the hilly, cold mountainsides of Vermont.
Now, what about Australia? How did that connection get established there?
Yeah, so Australia imported Merino sheep right around the same time as Vermont in the late 1790s. Captain MacArthur, who was one of the kind of founders of the colony of New South Wales, picked up some merino sheep in South Africa. In fact, on his way to Australia. Australia has an even more kind of extreme climate than Vermont does. It's almost the whole continent. It's an island continent. Is hot and dry, and very few European transplants, plants or animals thrived in Australia, with the exception of merinos at the time. So they became wildly popular there as well. And by the time, by the 1870s, when the Vermont type of merino goes to Australia, there's already a massive and really lucrative merino production system in place in Australia.
So these merino sheep, you say, around the 1870s, were sent directly to Vermont, from Vermont to Australia. Is that right?
Well, they were sent, yeah. I think they were sent by way of San Francisco, actually, because they spent, it's a pair, the Vermont, I think it was the Vermont Sheep Merino Sheep Breeders Association. It's been a little bit hard to kind of track down exact information about this pair. I came across them in some newspaper articles from New South Wales, from Sydney, around 1879. They spent a couple months in quarantine, which suggests that they traveled overland by rail from Middlebury, from Addison County, to San Francisco, and then from there by ship, obviously, to Sydney. Australia actually had a very strict rule against importing foreign animals because of something called scab, which is like a skin disorder that sheep get. But they broke it for this particular pair and allowed them to be exhibited at the big colonial agricultural fair.
And that turns out to be a case of be careful what you wish for, because apparently these merinos brought some real problems with them once they got to Australia.
Well, they were very different than Australian merinos. Australian merinos, they were called smooth-bodied, so their skin fit relatively tightly over their skeleton, whereas Vermont merinos, what was distinctive about them was that they were incredibly wrinkly, so they were like kind of had folds of skin from head to toe. And once Australian breeders started breeding this American type, the Vermont type, to their smooth-bodied merinos, it became difficult to later on remove that trait. So there was a fashion in Australia for wrinkly sheep from about 1880 until 1906. And then suddenly in 1906, breeders decided they wanted, there was the pendulum swung back to plain-bodied merinos. But by then, yeah, from the perspective of some Australian breeders, by then the damage was done.
Were there other physical attributes to the merino sheep from Vermont that were problematic as well?
Well, their wool was, they grew much, much more wool. It's a heavier wool with more lanolin in it, what they called oil or yolk, depending on who was riding. And they had more of that than Australian sheep. Australian type of merino tended to be a little bit drier in the wool, but more fine. So Vermont merinos were slightly heavier, coarser kind of wool. Again, this was something that Australian breeders debated the merit of. You know, you could get more wool on an animal. I mean, you could sort of, it was a question of quantity over quality with the Vermont versus the Australian kind of wool.
And apparently there were some other problems that went beyond the physical. I mean, it seems that some Australians were resentful in a way of this invading species, if you will. I mean, because they were not native to Australia.
Yeah, they were. There was kind of heated, what I think was a heated discussion in one of the meetings of the New South Wales Agricultural Society, who was the recipient of this gift from the Vermont counterpart. The newspapers at the time tend to be relatively circumspect, but they did say that there was a conversational discussion in which some Australians referred to the Vermonts as a white elephant and so much trash. Later on, others sort of, there's a well-known agricultural reporter for a different paper who chastised these fellows for looking a gift sheep in the mouth, and said, what a way to repay Vermont's kindness. So there was also a lot of talk about trying to send a return gift to Vermont. But basically, it was a kind of a controversial import, for sure.
Well, as I said in the intro, the dairy cow is really the animal we think of today when we think of Vermont species. But Australians apparently have a longer memory when it comes to the merino sheep. I mean, do they still talk about this to this day?
I'm sorry, does who still talk about
it? The Australians.
The Australians. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, because they're, the merino remained and still is in many places central to parts of the Australian economy in a way that it's not anymore in Vermont. So, Yeah, so it functions kind of, the merino sheep functions more like the dairy cow in Australia than it does in Vermont. I think that the dairy has always been dominant in Vermont, so the merino would have had a kind of pretty tough uphill battle to displace it in the 19th century, but it did rival it for a time.
Amazing. Great history there, and you'll be talking about this at the Vermont Historical Society. Rebecca Woods is a lecturer in history at Columbia University who specializes in environmental history and the history of science. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for today. Tomorrow, as the U.S. promises to accept more refugees, we'll take a look at the past and future of refugee resettlement here in Vermont. Send your questions and comments to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from our new intern, Hannah Kearns. Liam Connors directed the program today. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Mitch Wertlieb, in for Jane Lindholm, and thanks so much for listening today to Vermont Edition.